They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Technically, Ben Bernanke's testimony today was called the semi-annual monetary policy report to the Congress. Another way to say that might be, hey, Ben, how are you going to fix this thing? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Marketplace Whiteboard, videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis. You can watch them anytime at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Tuesday, the 21st of July. Good to have you with us, as always, everybody. There was a real risk that our lead story today was going to be packed with words like liquidity and tightening of monetary policy. That's the chance you take when you talk about the chairman of the Federal Reserve going to Capitol Hill to testify. Instead, though, we thought we'd use the actual English translations of those words. For almost a year now, the Fed has been pumping an unprecedented amount of money into the economy to get it going again. That would be liquidity. At some point, though, all that easy money sloshing around could spark an unprecedented case of inflation, which could result in higher interest rates, which would be the tightening. But Mr. Bernanke took pains today to assure Congress he can handle it. John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
With no inflation in sight and the economy still not creating jobs, Bernanke said he and his colleagues at the Fed will keep interest rates low for the time being.
However, we also believe that it is important to assure the public and the markets that the extraordinary policy measures we have taken in response to the financial crisis and the recession can be withdrawn in a smooth and timely manner as needed.
When the time comes to battle inflation, Bernanke said he plans to use a new weapon Congress gave the Fed last fall. Economist Nigel Gault at IHS Global Insight says the central bank can now pay banks to keep their money at the Federal Reserve.
By raising the interest rate that it pays on reserves deposited at the Fed, banks will choose to keep those reserves on deposit at the Fed rather than lending them out into the economy.
But here's the tough part. When does the Fed start using tools like that? Timing is crucial, and Bernanke was asked today, how will he know?
Since monetary policy takes time to work, the only way we can do that is by trying to make a forecast. And we use large amounts of information, including qualitative information, anecdotes we receive, formal models, a whole range of techniques to try to estimate where the economy is likely to be a year or a year and a half from now. It's a very uncertain business, but it's really all we can do.
Working in the Fed's favor is a prediction the recovery will be gradual, giving policymakers a longer window to get the timing right. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So as you might have heard, California has a budget, almost, after weeks or months, really, of bickering. State lawmakers and Governor Schwarzenegger have seen eye to eye. They have a plan to close our $26 billion budget crater with a vote expected on Thursday. Seeing as how we're actually here in California, though, and we've been through this before, we're not going to make any predictions about that one. And the details are still fuzzy at best, but Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports some of the proposed cuts could wind up costing more money than they save.
Some of the savings will come from reducing services, like health care for children and the elderly, but that will just drive up emergency room visits where medical care is more expensive. Part of the budget shortfall will be covered by the state borrowing from county coffers. John Elwood is a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley.
A lot of the borrowing appears to be coming by borrowing from other levels of government. and they are going to scream bloody murder, but they can't do much about it.
As counties are forced to loan money to the state, they will have to cut services and jobs. President Obama has said that during the recession, when people are out of work, it makes sense to go back to college and get retrained. But California is dramatically reducing enrollment at its community colleges and universities. Stephen Levy is director of the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy.
The budget cuts for higher ed are penny-wise and pound-foolish. Looking over the next 10 years, we're disinvesting where we ought to be investing.
The budget gap will also be closed by some fancy accounting. State employees will get paid at the end of each month so that the payment shows up on next month's ledger instead of this month's. John Elwood explains how that works.
When I worked for the federal government, we did this all the time. You would take payments and shift them from one fiscal year to the next fiscal year, and then you'd get to the next fiscal year and you'd shift them back to the previous fiscal year. Nothing has really changed there, but it makes it look good on the books.
That means the budget shortfall isn't really fixed. Instead, it's effectively punted for others to worry about down the line. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
We're set to hear from more financial institutions this week about their earnings. Morgan Stanley reports tomorrow. American Express follows on Thursday. At this point, you've probably heard JPMorgan Chase and Goldman Sachs did pretty well in the second quarter, and that Goldman is set to hand out billions of dollars in bonuses this year. That's all just a little too much for President Obama, as he explained on NBC's Today Show this morning.
What you haven't seen, I think, is a change in culture, a certain humility, where they kind of step back and they say, gosh, you know, we really messed things up.
A certain humility from Wall Street. An interesting concept, but maybe we ought not hold our breath. Here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson.
It may not look like humility, but what you don't see from Wall Streeters could be more telling than what you do.
They know they screwed up.
That's former investment banker Doug Elliott, now with the Brookings Institution in Washington. He says just consider that the big banks aren't trying very hard to stop the president's plans for regulatory reform. If the Obama administration and Congress don't see that as humility, Elliott says, it could be because of a culture clash that isn't going anywhere anytime soon.
Certainly people in Washington who do have their own brand of arrogance have a different approach to things, and communications between New York and Washington can be very difficult at times.
David Shulman worked on Wall Street for 20 years, but now his Canelli suit's in the closet and he walks around in a windbreaker and a baseball cap. He's senior economist with the UCLA Anderson Forecast. He agrees Wall Streeters are exhibiting humility to the extent they can, given their day jobs.
It's a very tough game. And to do well against extraordinary competition in very, very fiercely competitive markets is just as ego-gratifying as pitching a no-hitter in the World Series.
Shulman says they can't take off their game face if they're to keep making money to pay back us taxpayers, even if they're forced to take huge bonuses while they do it.
It wouldn't surprise me that at the end of the year you'll see extraordinarily large charitable contributions coming from people who received huge bonuses this year.
That's how they'll show their remorse.
That may be one way of showing remorse.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Traders fought their way back from a down day today, remorse or no. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to take a second to revisit the eye-popping number we ended the broadcast with yesterday, $23.7 trillion. It comes courtesy of Neil Barofsky. He's the Special Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Relief Program. In other words, Barofsky is the guy who's supposed to be keeping track of exactly how that $700 billion banking bailout is being spent. And he is doing that. But in a report he delivered today officially, Barofsky did something else, too. He outlined what he believes is the U.S. government's total possible liability as a result of its response to the financial crisis, that $24 trillion figure. It's an interesting number to know, I suppose, but is it right and does it matter? Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Remember last fall when $700 billion sounded like a lot of money? Well, according to Neil Barofsky, it's just a tiny fraction of the $23.7 trillion the U.S. has at risk in the bailout.
My initial response was this was a WTF number. And you know what those initials stand for.
Barry Ritholtz is the author of Bailout Nation. He says to get this figure, the banking bailout's chief watchdog included the price of every federal program, even ones that haven't really gotten off the ground. Then Borofsky's office assumed that everything that possibly could go wrong would. That would mean that every federally guaranteed mortgage defaults, every bank collapses. Ritholtz says the government really hasn't spent anywhere close to $23 trillion. Instead, he says, this is Borofsky's estimate of the total size of the government's guarantees to the financial sector.
Yes, it is money at risk. Now, even though the vast majority of it is not a high risk, it's still money at risk. It's still possible that events could go awry that leads to a healthy chunk of that money not coming back to the taxpayer.
Simon Johnson at MIT quibbles with some of the calculations Borofsky used to come up with his $23 billion figure.
But I think what Mr. Borofsky is signaling is that there are very big fiscal costs, both obvious and hidden, involved in this rescue.
Big indeed. The amount of money at risk is almost eight times the size of the federal budget. And if the government ends up losing just 10%, taxpayers will be stuck with a multi-trillion dollar bill. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The Treasury Department released data on its Build America Bonds program yesterday. BABs, as they're called, are municipal bonds, or munis, on which the federal government pays part of the interest. Since the program was rolled out this past April after the stimulus bill passed, cities and counties in 34 states have raised almost $18 billion from BABs. The name kind of implies a grand plan for construction and creating new jobs, which it is. But Sally Herships reports now from New York. There is some financial engineering going on here, too.
We need Build America bonds, not just to build America, but to rebuild the municipal bond market. Local governments sell muni bonds to raise money for things like schools and freeways. And when the market works properly, it looks like a freeway. Bonds fly back and forth as local governments sell and investors buy. But to keep those bonds on the road, the market needs a key player, the bond insurer.
For about the last 20 years, bond insurance was a part of the market.
Amy Resnick is editor-in-chief of the newspaper Bond Buyer.
And about 50% of all municipal bonds sold carried an insurance policy that promised the investor that even if the government couldn't pay it back, the insurance policy would cover you and you'd get your money back.
For years, bond insurance kept the muni market running smoothly, until last September when the financial crisis hit and our smooth-running freeway turned into a parking lot. Nobody wanted to buy muni bonds after they learned the insurers were guaranteeing billions in mortgage-backed securities. As those securities turned toxic, some insurers looked like they might not be able to cover their liabilities. They stretched way too thin.
So that insurance policy that investors relied on was now maybe not even any more reliable than the underlying government that was being insured.
Muni bonds are stuck in traffic right when municipalities need money more than ever. Charles Jones is a professor of finance at Columbia University. He says, enter the U.S. Treasury, like a tow truck riding to the rescue.
The idea here is we come in and we jumpstart the market with the government's Build America bonds.
Jones says the Treasury is offering a special deal. It subsidizes just over a third of the interest payments on every Build America bond sold. That lets the municipality jack up the interest rate and makes the bonds more attractive to investors.
And the advantage of this form of the subsidy is that it's going to broaden out the set of investors who can buy this.
It also means a municipality pays out less in interest than it did before.
With a municipality, if it pays a lower interest rate, it can do more investing in roads and other projects.
Hopefully getting traffic in the bond market and the economy flowing again. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, paying up for past wrongdoing.
the impoverishment brought about by the transatlantic slave trade still affects much of the west coast of Africa.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 0.75% today, 67 points, 8,915 the number. The NASDAQ ticked up a third of 1%, nearly 7 points, finished at 1916. The S&P 500 rose 0.3%, 3 points, ended at 954. This just in, CIT is still in trouble. Worries that the business lender could be forced to file for bankruptcy dragged the market down in the early part of the session. The company stock ended down 21% today. But a slew of good earnings numbers eclipsed that bad news. Caterpillar tracked up 7.75%. Merck popped up 6.1%. United Airlines took off more than 5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.48%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis. Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, President Obama meets with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing on the semiannual monetary policy report to Congress. And it's the birth anniversary of the man who brought us the mobile. The sculpture, not the auto. Artist Alexander Calder was born on July 22, 1898. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Oil prices rose today. Crude inched a bit closer to $65 a barrel. That price bumps around quite a bit as the economic news changes, but oil and gas are still far cheaper than they were last summer. Thing is, though, that they'll eventually get back to where they were in 2008, and even higher probably, too. In his new book, $20 a Gallon, Forbes writer Chris Steiner imagines what life will be like when that happens. Things won't be all bad, he says, once we get used to it.
We've hit a plateau as far as how much the world produces, you know, in the low 80 million barrel per day range. The problem is that there's about 2 billion people who are going to join the ranks of Americans in living the kind of lifestyles we live in the next 30 years.
Those 2 billion extra people who are going to be living our lifestyle, you're talking basically China and India, yes?
They're a big part of it. Yeah, China and India are a big part of it. China by itself is going to add another America worth of energy consumption by the year 2040.
All right, so let's explore this thought experiment that you call it in your book. We'll go through the chapters. Now, I will point out that you've cleverly named these chapters after gasoline prices. So you've got chapter $4 a gallon, chapter $6 a gallon. What is going to be the tipping point?
Well, there's a lot of tipping points, and I think the point is that there's different tipping points at every price. I kind of think $6 per gallon is going to be a light switch for the American people. I think most people walk away from SUVs forever. I think people will think twice about flying places. Most people are going to understand that life won't be the same, and we have to change the way we do things.
I want to skip right to chapter $12 a gallon.
That's where we kind of forecast that people will finally come to the grips with the fact that the freestanding house with a quarter acre of land or a half acre of land 50 miles outside the city isn't a sustainable way to live. And they're going to get into places that are more walkable and denser.
All right, so let's play that out a little bit. If we all move to inner cities, you point out that some of those big box retail stores that are sort of set apart from society that you have to drive to in large measure, we're going to be left with carcasses of Walmarts and Targets and Best Buys out there.
Yeah, they call those ghost boxes. When Walmart leaves a store, they call it a ghost box. And there's actually 300 ghost boxes around the country right now. But by the time gas gets to $14, the Walmart model won't be very tenable. They're going to shut down.
Are you saying that Walmart's going to go out of business because we're not driving there anymore? Or is it all the rest of it that goes with Walmart, the shipping and the scale and all that?
Walmart is a company with 6,000 suppliers, 80% of whom are in China. And so they ship this stuff over on cargo ships very cheaply. it gets to the ports, and then Walmart has 7,000 trucks they use to disseminate it to 4,000 different stores in America. It's a network built on gasoline, and the only reason it works is cheap oil. Now, Walmart could morph. I mean, they're a smart company. They could turn into something else. But in the current form, we know Walmart, it won't survive.
But if at $12 a gallon we're driving, you know, by factors of 10 less than we're driving today, I have images of weeds sprouting up on the I-405 here in Los Angeles and the 10 that goes across the country crumbling into the soil. I mean, is that what you're envisioning here?
I think some roads will close down, and I think a lot of the roads are going to go to tolls. We certainly don't need the giant infrastructures of roads that we have in places like Chicago and Los Angeles right now. I mean, there's a highway every 2 miles. The nice thing is that it gives us thoroughfares that we can use for trains and other modes of transportation that would be impossible to put in because people live in these places without those roads being there. So they'll actually come quite in handy.
So it's really a good thing.
Well, it depends how you look at it.
I mean,
if you have a giant house and you have three SUVs, this isn't a good thing. But I think everybody will be surprised, as they usually are, at how well most of us adapt.
Christopher Steiner's book on the looming gas apocalypse and how it actually might be good for us is called $20 per gallon. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
The head of the United Nations panel on climate change said today he thinks the world's biggest economies are blowing it. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore a couple of years ago. Today, its chairman, Rajendra Pachauri, said the group of 8 industrialized countries had, quote, clearly ignored his panel's advice. There's a big push on to come to some kind of international agreement on global warming before a key UN conference at the end of the year in Copenhagen. But commentator Glenn Hubbard thinks the U.S. approach to climate change has a fatal flaw.
Global climate change is an important subject, even at the recent G8 summit. And the Congress and the Obama administration are on the case. Or are they? By a very narrow margin, the House of Representatives passed its climate change bill, broadly supported by the administration, earlier this month. The central element is a cap-and-trade system for greenhouse gases. The cap-and-trade would set emission limits nationally and require emitters to own permits or allowances to cover their emissions. The legislation made a mistake so big that the House should start over. It created a huge new corporate welfare program. First, two things. Done properly, like a tax, a cap-and-trade system can give the right price signal to reduce emissions. Economists generally like this approach, citing the success of such a program in reducing sulfur dioxide emissions in the 1990s. And also, like a tax, the system can generate a lot of money, in this case by auctioning allowances. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office tells us those allowances could be worth $1 trillion over the next decade and much more in decades to come. So far, so good. Now comes the mistake. The House dropped the ball. It would give away 3/4 of the allowances. If instead the government auctioned all of the allowances, almost $750 billion would be raised over the next 10 years. This action would reduce emissions, and funds could be used to cut corporate taxes to improve growth. Adding insult to injury, it would spend the other 1/4 of the allowances. Little improvement in emissions, no deficit relief, big new tax. Uh-oh. Memo to the Senate, cut off the House's allowances and send it back to the drawing board.
Glenn Hubbard is dean of the Graduate School of Business at Columbia University. Your thoughts are always welcome. Online works best. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There's a university project going on over in Britain that's causing quite a stir in that country's business community. A team of researchers is compiling a database of every British company that has historic ties to the slave trade. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports the uncomfortable discoveries have already begun.
You will be sold.
This exhibition in the London Docklands not only recreates some of the miseries of the slave trade, it also demonstrates the depth of Britain's involvement. Museum guide Daniel Nunes says the site of this exhibition is significant.
You're in warehouse number one. There were 9 of them originally, and they stretch for more than 0.5 miles, the largest brick building in the world.
Before the slave trade was abolished, these warehouses would have been packed with up to 20,000 casks of rum and 80,000 barrels of sugar from the West Indies.
The product of slavery ended up here and was stored in these very warehouses that you're in now.
It's also well known that London helped finance and insure the slave trade, but how big a role did this barbaric business really play in the British economy as a whole? Catherine Hall, Professor of History at University College London, has just launched a major study to find out
to what extent slavery as an institution contributed to the development of Britain as the major industrial society, the dominating world power in the 19th and early 20th century.
With fellow historian Nick Draper, Catherine has embarked on a three-year project compiling a list of every company and individual that profited from slavery. They're trawling through an extraordinary but little-known record.
This, in fact, is a merchant called Thomas Philpotts in Trelawney, Jamaica.
Wonder which plantation?
In 1833, Britain abolished slavery throughout its empire, and the government paid a huge sum to compensate slave owners. Catherine and Nick are now poring over the archive, identifying those who claimed compensation. Among them, the highly respected merchant bank Rothschilds.
That claim was transferred to the Rothschilds as part of a private banking transaction between Rothschilds and the client.
They were using slaves as collateral?
They were indeed.
Another big name in the City of London has also been shown to have benefited from slavery. It's one of today's top four law firms, Freshfields.
It tends to highlight how slavery and slave ownership permeated British society, even in places where you wouldn't expect to find it.
Rothschilds and Freshfields have both issued statements regretting their historic links with what they call this abhorrent trade. Both insist their forebears actually opposed slavery. Neither firm wants to make any further comment, but Aidan McQuaid of Anti-Slavery International certainly does.
The impoverishment brought about by the transatlantic slave trade still affects much of the west coast of Africa.
And he has a suggestion for Rothschilds and Freshfields.
That they should invest 1% of their pre-tax profits in programs of democratic development in the countries which were devastated by slavery at that time.
No lawsuit seeking reparations for the slave trade has ever succeeded, but American campaigners have made some headway. They've persuaded a number of US banks and insurance companies to express regret for the sins of their forebears. J.P. Morgan set up a $5 million scholarship fund for African-American pupils. As the slave trade database expands here in Britain, British companies will be invited to follow the American example. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, Twisted Irony Department. Last year, the insurance company AIG, it of the credit default swaps and systemic risk and billions in government bailouts, well, they had a little party for some of their executives at a resort hotel here in Southern California. We got word today that the St. Regis Monarch Beach in Dana Point has been seized by Citigroup. Its owners defaulted on a $70 million loan from Citigroup. Clearly, they didn't have any insurance on that loan from, oh, I don't know, AIG. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 67 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ added 7 points, 0.33%. The S&P 500 nudged up almost 1 point, 0.1%. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this radio broadcast, the benefits of counting carbon actually do start to add up.
Companies like a Starbucks or a Whole Food, they need, for competitive reasons, to protect their brand, to attract the best and brightest, do need to be increasingly more environmentally responsible.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.